Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Captives, How Rikers Island Took New York City Hostage, by Jared Shanahan. Narrated by Greg Tremblay. Introduction. If you build it, they will fill it. Obscenity. On the evening of September 24th, 1954, a woman, locked on the fourth floor of New York's House of Detention for Women, HDW, was accused of making an obscene comment toward a guard. Escorted to her cell as punishment, the woman, identified by officials only as a narcotic addict, loudly denied the charges, protesting the injustice of her treatment. Her defiant clamor fell on sympathetic ears. Other women inside rose to her defense, shouting protestations of their own. In response, the guards shut off the lights for the entire floor, much as one might send a recalcitrant child to bed early. Nevertheless, consigned to the dark, the women took to their cell windows, broadcasting rebellion to other floors of HDW. At least one of those floors joined in, while their message reverberated among the people in the bustling streets of Greenwich Village below. For 2 hours, the women set small fires, clanged their metal cups against the bars, and shouted protests to the unruly crowd that gathered on the sidewalk, until the onlookers were forcibly dispersed by a detachment of 15 cops. The spirited demonstration inside ended only with the arrival of acting jail superintendent Loretta Moran, roused from the comfort of her home by their direct action, who restored the lights. Flanked by guards who just hours earlier had shut the women up in the dark, the official toured the jail to speak face-to-face with HDW's captive population, who shared their grievances. As social anthropologist Orisanmi Burton observes, jails and prisons seek legitimacy through their alleged ability to impose order on captive populations, thereby defending the order of society at large. Incidents like the rebellion at HDW challenge this legitimacy. By shattering the surface order these institutions must display to the broader society, such production of disorder is, therefore, a powerful weapon for captive populations. In the aftermath of this well-publicized incident, the local press held the New York City Department of Corrections, DOC, to account, prompting it to respond directly to the women's charges of poor conditions in the facility with promises of reform. For its part, DOC blamed the disorder on persistent overcrowding, a lack of medical, psychological, and psychiatric treatment services, untrained staff, and pervasive idleness in the facility. A familiar refrain from jail administrators, leaning heavily on factors that can only be remedied by increases in their own budgets. A subsequent internal investigation reiterated these findings, to which it added two telling details. First, it was commonplace at HDW for women to be denied basic rights, such as visitation, as they suffered the facility's abysmal conditions. Second, women classified as narcotic addicts suffered the additional indignity of being forced to wear blue chambray dresses that marked them as a particular class of prisoner. Filling out this picture, the New York Herald Tribune reported that, contrary to DOC's claims that the conflict began in a common area, the unrest had actually begun in a room called the Tank, an added level of captivity and indignity for women deemed narcotic addicts. Responding to media scrutiny, city officials demanded DOC get the situation at HDW under control. The New York City Board of Estimate promptly pivoted from pleading poverty with regard to the city jails to discovering $108,794 in available funds, which was passed along to DOC in hopes it would help calm the facility. Jail administrators have long cultivated the art of explaining prisoner unrest in terms flattering to polite society and supportive of higher budgets and more power for corrections departments. The primary cause of this disturbance, however, was more than a mere amalgamation of poor conditions and surely not a deficit of institutional capacity. It was instead fundamentally tied to the broader historical moment that produced it. As the Great Migration from the Jim Crow South redoubled following World War II, New York City saw a sizable influx of African-American residents, ultimately numbering in the millions. In New York, they faced a northern variety of segregation: marginalization from employment and housing, and criminalization by police, courts, and jails. The typical prisoner at HDW at this time was Black, between 25 and 30 years of age, hailed from outside of New York State, possessed an elementary school education, and was locked away on charges of disorderly conduct, drug possession, or sex work for an average of 5 months. These women were designated second-class citizens from birth and denied adequate housing, employment, and treatment before the law. In turn, they were deprived of their freedom for crimes attendant to daily survival. Perhaps they had believed a better life was in store for them in New York City, but HDW made plain a truth that Malcolm X would argue a decade later: if you Black, you were born in jail, in the North as well as the South. As long as you south of the Canadian border, you south. The reality of life in New York for these women was consignment to the lowest tiers of the labor force, whether in precarious legal employment or the harsh world of informal economies. In either case, they were subjected to perennial harassment by the cops, who represented the social order that simultaneously exploited their labor and made their daily lives as difficult as possible. Once imprisoned, these women struggled to eke out a dignified existence, packed for upward of 3 years into a cramped and squalid facility never intended for more than temporary detention. Surely the conditions inside jails constitute social ills sufficient to justify rebellion, but they are only part of the story. The deeper context in which such uprisings unfold is a broader and more complex social terrain, a radicalized social order defined by human disposability and held together by violence. When carceral facilities are thus situated, the question begging explanation is not, why do people sometimes rebel, but why, most of the time, don't they? A monument to those who conceived it. The setting of these dramatic events was a 12-story facility overlooking 6th Avenue, resembling an Art Deco high-rise and marked simply Number 10 Greenwich Avenue. Although nondescript by design, the facility nonetheless stood out. The idea was to make it look not like a jail at all, but like a new apartment building, writes essayist Tom Wolfe. In the place of bars, there are windows with a heavy grillwork holding minute square panes. The panes are clouded like cataracts. Actually, the effect is more like that of the power plant at Yale University, which was designed to resemble a Gothic cathedral, but in any case, it does not look like a jail. HDW was adjacent to the Jefferson Market Court in Greenwich Village, known for lively night sessions revolving around illicit street life, especially sex work. While the jail had become notorious in New York City long before the events of 1954, like many jails and prisons, its life began as product of a hard-fought campaign by progressive-era reformers, including the local temperance movement and the Women's Prison Association. Prior to the opening of HDW in 1932, women detained awaiting trial simply lived in police station cells, pending the outcome of their cases. Legal scholar Clarice Feinman describes a status quo in which detained women, mostly mendicants, prostitutes, vagrants, or elderly, were, regardless of age, offense, or health, housed together often in a common cell, and it was not unusual to have mothers with babes in arms among the women. They slept on wooden benches in unsanitary, vermin-infested surroundings. Sentenced women were confined on Welfare Island, previously Blackwell's Island and known today as Roosevelt Island, in a dangerous and squalid facility notorious for over half a century before HDW took its place. The opening of HDW was thus a victory for jail reformers, who pinned their hopes of fixing conditions in the city system on the erection of new jail facilities. The New York Times, which has rarely met a new city jail it did not celebrate in the rosiest of terms, praised the ample sunlight, air, and boarding house feel of this new facility, where cells were called rooms and rightly so. When HDW opened, one reformer called it a monument to those who conceived it. In short order, this remark would prove accurate. albeit far from the compliment intended. Reflecting on the infamous jail, the revolutionary scholar Angela Davis recalls, "I used to look up at this building almost every day, trying not to listen to the terrible noises spilling from the windows." In 1959, Davis was a new arrival to the city, thanks to a Quaker-run exchange program that placed Southern black students in integrated schools in the North. This had brought the teenager from Birmingham, Alabama, to Manhattan, where she attended Elizabeth Irwin High School in Greenwich Village, just down the street from HDW. The distressing sounds she heard were coming from the women locked behind bars, looking down on the people passing in the streets and screaming incomprehensible words. Davis was not alone in taking note of the suffering on display in Greenwich Village. Given the jail's central position in this bustling area, it was hard to ignore. Just a year after its opening, overcrowding at the facility was already earning criticism from the reformers who had fought for it to open. HDW had been designated for a small population of pretrial detainees, but almost immediately upon its opening, DOC had begun using HDW for its entire female population, packing in detainees and prisoners serving sentences upward of 3 years. Often, space was so limited in the facility that women were doubled up in the small, dark cells. A contemporary photograph shows how many women bided their recreation time sitting in the dingy hallway just outside these cells. The reformers, who had campaigned for the opening of this jail, it turned out, had no control over how it was used. By the mid-50s, this unfavorable view of the jail had taken hold in DOC itself. In the wake of the September 1954 disturbance, DOC's new commissioner, Anna M. Cross, a pioneering suffragist, court reformer, and herself an advocate for the construction of HDW, made no excuses for the facility. She called it a shocking penal anachronism. As for the women who rebelled there, Cross was even more direct. "I don't blame them one bit." Shocking penal anachronisms. By Cross's own account, the DOC she inherited in 1954 was still in the era of horse and buggy. Then, as now, DOC oversaw what was effectively a massive and diffuse county jail, including remand facilities for detainees and sentence institutions for convicted prisoners who were serving short sentences. Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx hosted borough-based remand facilities called city prisons. These held accused men while they awaited trial and caged city and state parole violators, as well as sentenced prisoners who were serving 10 days or less. The Manhattan facility remains colloquially known as the Tombs. The Tombs, named after its Egyptian revival architecture, dated back to 1838, when it had been erected on a public execution site that was older still. This was the facility of which one prominent visitor, Charles Dickens, wrote, "Such indecent and disgusting dungeons as these cells would bring disgrace upon the most despotic empire in the world." The Tombs was rebuilt twice following Dickens's visit, with the third incarnation opening in 1941, connected to the New York County Court at 100 Center Street. The Brooklyn facility, commonly known as the Raymond Street Jail, had been constructed over a century earlier, in 1836, and remodeled in 1909. Similarly, the Queens County Jail, now City Prison Queens, opened in 1875, while the Bronx City Prison was the newest jail built in 1938. By and large, these were crumbling facilities, designed for short-term incarceration, numbering in the days, and inadequate to detaining the rapidly climbing jail population of the post-war years. Most notably, this network of pretrial detention jails had no presence on Rikers Island. Rikers Island is a patch of reeking landfill plopped into the East River between LaGuardia Airport in Queens and Hunts Point in the Bronx. In 1954, the island was accessible only by a ferry system, which limited the island's capacity for daily traffic. The contemporary cliché that many New Yorkers cannot find Rikers on a map was doubtlessly truer in 1954, as the largely undeveloped island cut a slender figure in the city's institutional landscape. Nonetheless, it was a looming presence for New York City's sentenced male prisoners. the city and state correctional systems divided custody such that the city was responsible for detaining people prior to their trials and for incarcerating people serving clearly defined or determinate sentences of a year or less. It also held those serving indeterminate sentences stretching from 6 months to 3 years, the extent of which were at the discretion of the parole board. Rikers is sometimes referred to as a prison, but this is not technically correct. The facilities on Rikers are jails, a term that designates their use for pretrial or short-term incarceration conducted on the county, not state level. Rikers was, at this time, still a facility for sentenced men. Pretrial populations would come later. In 1954, male prisoners serving sentences of less than 6 months wound up at the Rikers Island Workhouse, largely for offenses such as disorderly conduct and public intoxication. If they were aged 16 to 30 and serving time on their first misdemeanor, they may have been sent to the New Hampton Reformatory in Orange County, New York, to perform agricultural labor. Prisoners serving more than 6 months were locked up in the Rikers Island Penitentiary. In both cases, the petty crimes prisoners were accused of and the working-class composition of these facilities benefited the historical role of the workhouse and short-stay jail. They were repositories of proletarians who refused to observe the dictates of the wage relation and the discipline it entailed, or else were simply in the way of the surface order that the state strove to cultivate. Anna M. Cross was a reform commissioner brought in by the incoming mayor, Robert Wagner Jr., to fix the embarrassing mess that the city jails had become in a post-war spike in incarceration played out against institutional inertia. Bearing the mantle of the New Deal, with which his father and namesake was associated in the minds of working-class New Yorkers, Wagner undertook a sweeping expansion of city employment and institutional capacity. The effort aimed to cohere a powerful working-class base among municipal workers and trade unionists and to generate widespread consensus for a Keynesian social order. His so-called New Deal for New York would be managed by union leadership and democratic politicians who would serve to temper unrestrained market development, providing robust social services and public sector employment. As part of this vision in the city jails, Cross endeavored to replace the untrained and often brutish guards who oversaw the city's captives with experts steeped in the social sciences, jailers who would approach incarceration from a clinical perspective and endeavor to solve the social ills that led to people being locked up in the first place. In post-war New York, the only thing that seemed impossible was that the future would resemble the past. Cross's struggle to remake DOC was therefore not unique. In this period, the governance of New York City was defined by two increasingly polarized camps. On one side stood humanistic liberals like Wagner, who approached the administration of social order as a project of generating the consent of the governed and administering their lives through robust public spending, legalistic trade unions, and a small army of experts trained in the social sciences. On the other side stood forces of brute repression, who believed that administering a well-ordered society began with a policeman's club and ended with a jail cell. This latter pole would, in short order, adopt the banner Law and Order. Make no mistake, both camps swore allegiance to the capitalist order and believed in the ultimate legitimacy of whatever means were necessary to protect it, something that would become especially clear amid rebellion against capitalism and white supremacy in the ensuing decades. But they remained two distinct visions of the post-war order and how it was to be achieved and maintained. And while the Law and Order camp was nascent in Cross's day, her 12-year stewardship of DOC coincided with the emergence of a powerful political base for it. When Cross condemned DOC as antiquated, she counterposed a medical model for understanding criminality that sought to undertake nothing short of human engineering, in her words. Cross was very much an orthodox product of the progressive era. She followed the trail blazed by the likes of social work pioneers Josephine Shaw Lowell and Louisa Lee Schuyler and Catherine Bement Davis, the first female commissioner of DOC, a distinction often wrongly applied to Cross. These reformers pursued a distinct course of public administration by deploying courts and carceral facilities to function as agencies of social work, dramatically expanding, in the process, the role of police, courts, and jails in the lives of working-class people. By the late 19th century, the emergent problems of urban administration, including the prevention of outright proletarian insurrection, but also more fundamental questions of sanitation, public assistance, and care for the needy and delinquent young, proved too daunting for localist machine politics. As cities expanded, governance was seized by experts representing the specializations of medicine, law, and public administration. As historian David Rothman demonstrates, this was an era in which probation, juvenile courts, and all manner of progressive prison schemes were deployed by an ascendant class of university-trained social managers as a humanistic alternative to discredited institutions of punishment and social control. By mid-century, when she took over DOC, Cross was part of an international movement of what criminologist David Garland calls penal welfarism. This approach to public administration combines the liberal legalism of due process and proportionate punishment with a correctionalist commitment to rehabilitation, welfare, and criminological expertise. This was not mere benevolence. It was a distinct paradigm for how social order could be maintained in a capitalist society defined by the concentration of property and power in a small set of hands. To meet the problems of this society, Cross believed jails could be repurposed to produce well-adjusted workers, if only these jails could be built properly and run by the right people. Accordingly, Cross's reform agenda rested on two vital elements. The first was to wrest control of the city jails from the paramilitary organization of uniformed staff, with its hierarchical structure of insularity and distrust of outsiders, and to establish the dominion of civilian experts over DOC. The second was to create the proper jail infrastructure to allow these experts to properly administer New York City's working class. This would require significant expansion of the city system, namely the construction of new jails and other infrastructure designed to facilitate rehabilitation. Social change, however, does not unfold as the coherent application of a single individual's clever plans. It is instead produced by the clash of antagonistic forces vying through contests large and small to impose their will on human events. Ultimately, Cross was able to get much of the infrastructure she wanted, most notably, a bridge connecting Rikers Island to the mainland, which greatly improved vehicular access and opened the land to significant carceral development. But Cross had little control over how these facilities would actually be run, who would administer them, and ultimately, who would govern the city in which jails play such an important role. "We plan," runs an old Yiddish proverb. God laughs. Captives. This book tells the story of the post-war struggle for who would run New York City, beginning with Wagner's New Deal for New York and Cross's penal welfarism, and culminating in the triumph of the twin figures we today call neoliberalism and mass incarceration. Following legal scholar James Forman, Jr., Captives endeavors to treat these immense social processes as the result of a series of small decisions made over time by a disparate group of actors. What follows is, then, not an exhaustive history of these scourges. It is instead a view of this epoch through the figure of the city jail, with an emphasis on the small decisions and daily struggles of disparate actors who crisscross its institutional world. The relationship between structure and agency is dialectical, writes post-war historian Thomas Sugrue, and history is the synthesis. Ultimately, in charting the unfolding of this dialectic, Captives tells the story of how the Rikers Island of today and the social order it represents came to be. Despite its central role in reproducing social life in New York City, the existing literature on this pivotal historical period makes scant reference to the city jail system. Most prominently, the system is absent from Joshua Freeman's canonical study of this period, Working Class New York. This is unfortunate, given the millions of working-class New Yorkers, disproportionately black and brown, who cycled through it during the period Freeman lionizes as the apex of U.S. social democracy. Meanwhile, he celebrates the emergence of city unions, one of the most powerful of which was that representing jail guards. "I am invisible, understand," recounts the narrator of Ralph Ellison's 1952 novel Invisible Man, "simply because people refuse to see me. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves, or figments of their imagination, indeed, everything and anything, except me." Freeman and others who omit the jail and its denizens from the history of post-war New York not only erase the people whose lives played out in the city's jail system, on one side of the bars or the other, but also play directly into the city's strategy to conceal the most dramatic expressions of social problems by quarantining them behind high walls. As the 1954 rebellion at the House of Detention for Women demonstrates in a radical sense, the boundaries between the jails and the rest of the society are, in fact, quite porous. Jails are blunt yet essential tools by which capitalist order is maintained and negotiated. Therefore, they are just as vital, if not more so, to their given societies than other institutions, factories, schools, political parties, and unions, that might be easier to plumb for progressive politics or more pleasing to look at. Yet the political deployment of the jail represents, in a most extreme form, the conflicts and contradictions that define a given social order. It is at once a key terrain on which that order is inscribed and the grounds where it is contested. When struggles and scandals break out of jails and into the wider public discourse, they tend to threaten the legitimacy not just of the jail as an institution, but of the broader society it serves to prop up. As the listener is surely aware, the unfolding conflict in post-war New York was characterized by persistent violence, at times routine to the point of banality, at times spectacular. Any effort to depict the violence of structural racism and incarceration in particular is a fraught undertaking. To present violence in graphic detail risks turning human misery into an entertaining commodity, all in the name of proving things that most listeners already know. The United States is an incredibly violent society, especially for working-class black people, and U.S. prisons are places where sadism and brutality thrive. With this in mind, I strive to present violence judiciously in the service of what the listener likely doesn't already know. The book's most violent episodes constitute a series of events central to the unfolding of New York City carceral history and the history of the city itself that have been scarcely documented, will be completely unknown to the vast majority of listeners, and that polite society would happily forget. They're recounting, therefore, attempts to balance a respectful explication of violence undergone by real people in the recent past with the historian's responsibilities to record events as they transpired, and to foster greater understanding of the world we inhabit today. The listener might be surprised to discover that Rikers Island cuts a modest shadow in the book's early chapters. The explanation for this is simple. In the immediate post-war period, Rikers Island was not the central node of working-class life that it would later become. Further, while the central concerns of this book limit much of its discussion to New York City by necessity, many of the trends explored herein can serve as case studies of national phenomena, including post-war dislocation, deindustrialization, black and brown power, the law and order movement, the so-called punitive turn in governance, and the creation of the largest captive population on Earth. In the case of the New York City fiscal crisis, the attendant onset of neoliberalism as the city's governing paradigm, and the massive prison boom that came in its wake, New York was not simply emblematic of national changes, but a testing ground for a ruling class offensive that was subsequently carried out on a national scale. To make sense of the rise of Rikers Island as a central figure in New York City and the country at large, Captives looks beneath the surface order of not just the jail, but New York City as a whole. It finds there a crowded field of contending powers whose struggles shape the unfolding of long-term historical events. This entails spending considerable time dealing with mayors, DOC commissioners, and other custodians of social order whose employment hinges on the
sample complete. Ready to continue?